My grandfather told me he was too old for Halloween, so he's wearing his usual outfit. Polyester pants, button-up shirt and cardigan, black socks, and loafers. I convinced him to wear a neon orange ponytail holder so he would look a little Halloween-y. Don't tell me. My mom teases him. You're supposed to be an old man. My grandfather scowls at her. Ha ha! Ben greets trick-or-treaters while my mom takes us over to the youth center. We wait for Raj outside and check out the costumes. There are a lot of sexy-looking angels and devils. My favorite is two kids who have dressed up as Dorothy and the Tin Woodman, except they've switched it up. The boy is Dorothy, and the girl is the Tin Woodman. My grandfather asks,
Do you think they'll have caramel apples?
The flyer said that there would be food. Why?
I haven't had a caramel apple in years, he says.
Raj walks up, and he's not wearing any black at all. In fact, he's wearing green chino pants and a pink polo shirt that has the collar turned up. A white sweater is tied around his shoulders, and his belt has whales on it. He's traded in his black Doc Martens for brown loafers with no socks, and he's dyed his hair blonde and combed it back. I would hardly even recognize him, except for his piercings. What are you supposed to be? He sticks his hand in his pockets and slouches.
Preppy,
he says. I laugh. My grandfather shifts awkwardly.
So, what do we do now?
I think we're supposed to have fun, I say.
Fun? What a waste of time,
he grumbles. We pay our money and head inside. It's dark and music thumps out of the stereo. Black lights and orange day-glow decorations are everywhere. There are strobe lights and even a fog machine. My grandfather heads straight for the food, and we trail after him.
No caramel apples. It's a sad state of affairs when you can't get a caramel apple on Halloween,
he grouses. I feel a twinge of unease now that I'm here. I'm not much of a dancer, even though I've taken ballet, tap, and jazz. My parents are big believers that all theater people should know how to dance. It's the whole being on stage thing. I always freeze up or overthink the steps and how I look doing them. It's hard to relax when everyone is watching you. A bouncy pop song comes on.
Wanna dance?
Raj asks.
My dancing days are over,
my grandfather replies.
Not you, Raj clarifies. Ellie.
I feel my cheeks heat up. Sure, I whisper. I don't know if it's the music, or the dark, or the safety of the costume, but the nervousness I usually feel when stepping onto a dance floor melts away, and I find myself jumping and twirling next to Raj. The music pounds like a pulse through the floor, and it's so loud you can't think. It feels like the undertow of the ocean, and I'm just swept along, everything reduced to senses. The sticky heat of the air, the brush of an elbow, the flash of a strobe light. I'm a jellyfish glowing in the dark sea, bright and brilliant, just waiting to be discovered. When the music stops, my eyes meet Raj's, and we both gasp, grinning at each other. And then I look around for my grandfather. He's slumped in a chair on the side of the room, his head nodding into his chest, fast asleep, like an old man. Chapter 21. Candles. When I wake up, rainbow-colored helium balloons are bouncing on my ceiling, and I'm not 11 anymore. I haven't grown overnight or changed in any physical way, but I feel different. Everything feels more. My mom walks in, carrying the phone. It's your dad, she says, and hands it to me.
Happy birthday from Houston,
he calls over the line.
How's it feel to be the wizened old age of 12?
Great, I say.
You know what Shakespeare said about growing old?
What?
When the age is in, the wit is out.
Oh, I say.
Huh? It's from Much Ado About Nothing,
he informs me.
He's saying that when you get old, you lose your brains.
That's good.
Good?
Sure. At least I'll have an excuse when I don't get a perfect report card. He laughs. When I open my locker at school, there's a birthday card waiting for me from Brianna. I can't help but remember last year when she decorated my desk with crepe paper and flowers and brought in a whole box of cupcakes. The card seems a little sad. But the day gets better. At lunch, Raj hands me a present with a pink bow.
Hey,
he says.
Happy birthday.
How'd you know? I ask. My grandfather taps his chest.
I told him, of course.
I open the box and grin. It's a burrito from my favorite Mexican place. This is great. Thanks, I tell him. He blushes a little, looks away.
When I was a kid, there wasn't this much hoopla around birthdays,
my grandfather says from across the table.
You all want a ticker tape parade. Everything's too much with this generation.
You know, you're part of this generation now, Raj says.
I've noticed that grown-ups don't seem to get as excited about birthdays as kids do. My mom jokes that she stopped counting them, which makes me think, how many candles will you have on your cake this year? I ask my grandfather.
What?
He asks. For your birthday, because of the tea Melvinus, I explain. Will you have 77 candles or, like, 14? My grandfather blinks and then says,
I don't believe in birthdays.
My mom is a little surprised when I request French food for my birthday dinner.
French, not Mexican? She asks.
French, I say, and my grandfather gives me an approving look. The French restaurant where we go to dinner is small and intimate. The napkins are thick and ironed, and the waiter sweeps the crumbs off the table with a fancy little knife. I order coq au vin, and it's delicious. The waiter gives us bowls of sorbet between each course. But the best part of the meal is the end. Instead of a dessert cart, the waiter wheels out a cheese cart. There must be 20 kinds of cheese to choose from. Pasteur would be impressed. Then my mom breaks out the presents from her and my dad. A gift card to a place at the mall that sells hair accessories. A puzzle with a picture of a unicorn, 1,000 pieces, and a cell phone. There's even a cute case, pink with glitter. Finally, I say. Thanks! My mom smiles.
Use it wisely, she adds. Don't go over your minutes.
My grandfather hands me his present. It's a big box wrapped in shiny silver paper with a white bow. I tear the paper away and gasp in delight. A microscope!
It's a good one. Practically professional, my grandfather says.
I stare at the box. It feels like I've been officially ushered into a secret society of scientists. My grandfather points out the features.
Binocular eyepiece, halogen light, 4 objective lenses. Of course, I'll teach you how to use it.
Thank you, I tell him, and my throat feels thick. This is the best present ever.
Well, good,
he says, a little gruffly.
I'm glad you like it.
My mom watches this byplay with a funny look.
I thought the cell phone would be the best present ever.
After dinner, the waiter brings out a cake. There are 13 candles, 12 pink ones plus a rainbow candle to grow on. The whole restaurant sings Happy Birthday to me. I lean in and blow out my candles. One refuses to go out, and it takes 3 times before it's finally out. That night, I fall asleep dreaming of candles, hundreds of candles. They burn on and on, bright and defiant, never going out. Chapter 22, Growing Pains.
My grandfather walks into the kitchen a few mornings later carrying a bottle of pain pills. He pours a glass of water and pops a handful of pills.
"Are you okay?" I ask him.
He's pale, with dark circles under his eyes. He doesn't look good.
"I'm having growing pains,"
he grits out, pointing to his legs.
"The T. melanus must be regenerating my bones."
"Does it hurt a lot?" I ask.
"Let's just say I know what it felt like to be tortured on the rack."
My dad's back in town for the weekend. He appears at our front door after lunch, wearing worn-out jeans and a black T-shirt, and carrying his toolbox.
"Dad!"
I shout and fling myself at him.
"Reporting for duty,"
he tells me, holding up his toolbox.
"I hear there's a toilet that needs fixing."
My father is handsome. I don't say that just because I'm his daughter. He's the kind of man who women stop and stare at when he walks into a room. He's got thick, curly black hair and dark brown eyes. He's usually cast as the rake or the hero in a play.
"I miss working with my assistant,"
he winks at me.
"I brought your hammer."
To pay the bills when I was little, my dad did carpentry work and odd jobs, hauling me around in my baby carrier. When I started teething, I chewed the wooden handle of one of his hammers. It still has bite marks on it.
"Where's your mother?"
he asks. "At the high school. They're having trouble with the light board," I tell him. "She said you're cooking dinner." He looks around.
"You're here by yourself?"
"No, Melvin's in the den."
"All right,"
he says.
"She mentioned something about some long-lost cousin crashing here. Well, let's get that toilet out of the way."
We settle down in the bathroom, and my father snakes the toilet and then takes the lid off and tinkers around with the insides.
"That should do it,"
he says.
"You want to do the honors?"
I flush and the water goes down.
"You should have been a plumber," I say.
He gives a wry smile.
"I would have made a whole lot more money, that's for sure."
My grandfather walks into the bathroom holding the catcher and the rye. He freezes when he sees my father.
"You must be Melvin,"
my father says.
"I'm Ellie's dad, Jeremy."
He holds out his hand. My grandfather doesn't reciprocate.
"Did you wash that hand?"
he asks.
"Toilet water's clean," my father says.
"Then drink it,"
my grandfather replies. We stand there for a minute. Then my grandfather holds up his book.
"You gonna stand around yapping all day?"
my grandfather asks.
"I have homework to finish."
My father makes risotto for dinner. We sit outside on our tiny patio, and the adults drink red wine, and my grandfather and I have soda. Between the crisp air, the good food, and my parents trading gossip about theater friends, it feels like I'm watching a favorite television show. Except this time, my grandfather has a guest role as the silent, moody teenager. Or maybe he isn't acting. My father and grandfather have never exactly been buddies. When my parents first got married, my grandfather said some things to my father that involved the words punk, my daughter, and knocked up. Needless to say, there is no way we can let my dad in on the little secret about Melvin. My grandfather turns to my dad.
"So, I hear you're an actor. How's that working out for you?"
"Pretty good, actually," he says. "The tour of my production has been extended for another year."
"That's wonderful, Jeremy," my mother enthuses. "Congrats, Dad," I say. My grandfather doesn't look very impressed. He says,
"Lots of money performing in Peoria?"
"I'm in the union," my dad says.
"I've got a great benefits package."
My grandfather grunts. My dad smiles at him, faintly curious.
"You remind me of someone," he says.
"Really?"
my grandfather says.
"Who?"
"Just an old guy.
One of those grumpy types."
"Actually, you're distantly related to him. Guess Melvin is a family name."
My mom and I share a worried look. Then, without a word, My grandfather gets up and goes inside. My father turns to my mother.
Interesting kid, he says.
Teenagers, my mom says with a careless roll of her shoulders. All clear, I offer, and start picking up dishes. My parents beam at me. I stack the plates, and what I see when I go into the kitchen almost makes me drop them. My grandfather is pouring red wine into a plastic cup.
What are you doing? I hiss.
What does it look like I'm doing?
He says, and drinks from the cup.
But you can't.
Why not?
He grumbles.
It's not like I'm underage. And I need something to dull the pain. My legs are killing me.
The wine loosens my grandfather's tongue, and he starts to make even more snarky remarks at the dinner table.
To be or not to be 13, that is the question, he says.
My parents are deep in conversation and don't seem to notice what's going on. We move inside because it's getting chilly, congregating around the kitchen table.
I'm going to the bathroom,
my grandfather announces and walks out. My mother shakes her head and turns to my dad.
Were you like this as a teenage boy?
I'm not sure.
A puzzled look crosses my dad's face.
Mostly I remember being embarrassed by my parents all the time.
She changes the subject. So, spill. How's Francois? She makes air quotes with her hands when she says the name. Francois, I know, is the director of Les Miserables.
You mean besides having a French name but actually being from Long Island?
I knew it was a fake accent, my mom says.
He had a good speech coach somewhere along the line.
The toilet flushes. My father adds,
also, his ego is bigger than a blimp.
The toilet flushes again. Did you fix it? My mom asks him.
I fixed it, my father insists.
I think of all the pain pills Melvin took earlier. Worry spikes through me.
Maybe we should check on him, I suggest.
We find my grandfather hunched in front of the toilet, throwing up.
Oh no! Do you have food poisoning? My mom asks when my grandfather turns a gray face to her.
My father sniffs and looks furious.
Since when does food poisoning smell like red wine?
Chapter 23. Pizza Delivery. My grandfather is grounded. Raj and I wait for him by the flagpole after school. He waits with me most days now. He says the betting money's on my grandfather getting detention again. My grandfather comes running up to us. He's wild-eyed and frantic.
I know why they deactivated my key card. I know why they closed my email account, he exclaims.
Raj and I look at him.
The company's been bought. They're moving to Malaysia.
Malaysia? I ask.
It's all over the internet. Who knows what's going to happen to my T. Melvinus? They'll probably just throw it out.
He slams into the bathroom the minute we get home. I decide to set up my microscope and try to lure him out of his bad mood. It comes with a set of prepared slides. There's a fern spore, a cotton fiber, a salt crystal, and, oddly enough, a goldfish scale. I guess not everybody flushes their fish when they die. I look at the goldfish scale under the microscope. It's beautiful. A fan of color. And I think of all the Goldies. Maybe they would have lived if they'd had the T. Melvinus compound. Maybe we'd have a big tank of them swimming around. The doorbell rings, and when I answer it, a kid is standing there holding a pizza box.
Pizza delivery,
he says. His hair is in a mohawk, and he's got a few rings in his ears and one on his lip. Delivery boys always look a little sketchy. Like they're the kids the malls don't want to hire. Hang on, I say, and call my grandfather. Did you order a pizza?
Pepperoni,
the kid clarifies. My grandfather comes to the door.
I didn't order anything,
he says with a frown. What street number do you have? I ask the kid. He looks at the slip in his hand and gives an apologetic smile.
Oops, my mistake,
he says, and lopes away. As I watch him walk away, I remember my grandfather saying how the lab assistants like to eat pizza. I look at my grandfather and smile. I think I know how to get into Building 24. I detail my plan to Raj and my grandfather at the lunch court. Raj dresses up as a delivery kid. He takes a real pizza, and he gets buzzed in by the lab assistants. He drops it off, and on the way out, he grabs the T. Melvinus. That way, we don't have to worry about the security guard or the whole keycard thing.
Not bad, my grandfather says.
I turn to Raj. What do you think? Would you do it? He doesn't hesitate.
Sure, I'm in.
And your brother, too, my grandfather adds. We need a ride.
We plan it for Friday. That's the night my mom stays late to run lines with the actors. It should give us plenty of time to get to the lab and back home again without her finding out. It's perfect. Except that when Raj shows up on our front porch on Friday, he's alone.
Ananda's car is in the shop,
he explains. We stand around the kitchen trying to figure out what to do.
He said it should be fixed by next week, Raj tells my grandfather.
My grandfather is frustrated.
I don't want to wait until next week. Who knows what will happen in the meantime to my T. Melvinus?
So let's just take the bus,
Raj says.
Do you know how long it will take if we go by bus? We have to find a pizza place, and then get the pizza, and then take 4 buses to get there, and walk, and...
But I'm not listening to him. I'm too busy staring at my puzzle on the kitchen table. It's almost finished now. The bustle of the city, the people rushing down the sidewalk, the storefronts, the yellow taxicabs. Chapter 24. Nobel. People on television hop in and out of cabs all the time. It's like no big thing. But I've never been in one, and everything about it seems exotic. The meter on the dashboard, the smell of pine air freshener, the way the cab driver talks nonstop into his headset. He doesn't even seem surprised to have 3 kids in the back of his cab. My grandfather has the driver stop at a pizza parlor. He orders 2 pizzas, 4 sodas, and breadsticks, and gives the kid behind the counter an extra 100 for his cap, his shirt, and a cooler with the pizza place logo. It's almost 7 when we get to Building 24. There are only 2 cars in the parking lot. Looks quiet, I observe.
Typical Friday night,
my grandfather replies in a scathing voice.
Everyone leaves early. This generation has no dedication.
Raj puts on the shirt and cap. He looks perfect. I'm suddenly worried. I touch his arm. Don't get caught, I tell him. He looks at me steadily.
I won't,
he says.
I'm keeping the meter on,
the cab driver informs us loudly as Raj walks away. The meter ticks up. $40. $60, $70. And then Raj suddenly appears next to the cab, holding the cooler. A wave of relief rushes over me.
Did you get it?
My grandfather demands.
Yep,
Raj says.
It was a piece of cake.
They didn't even ask me who ordered it. The guy just waved me back.
My grandfather has the cab drop us off at a Chinese restaurant for an impromptu celebration.
Order anything you want,
he tells us.
I'm getting Mugu Gai Pan.
As if there was any question. Raj taps on the menu.
They have jellyfish. We should totally order it.
I grin. The food arrives, and we start eating. Raj bites into the jellyfish. What's it taste like? I ask him. He chews and keeps on chewing.
Rubber bands,
he says. I can't help myself. Jellyfish! You can use it to organize things! He catches my drift right away.
You can use it as an eraser! You can bounce it like a Super Bowl!
It's like the crispy corndog thing, only better. Raj and I out-jellyfish each other until we're laughing so hard we can barely breathe.
So, should I wear a bow tie?
My grandfather asks. Raj raises an eyebrow.
It's probably a bit much for middle school.
My grandfather corrects him.
No, to the Nobel ceremony. It's black tie.
Raj turns to me.
What should we wear? You?
My grandfather scoffs.
Excuse me? Who got the team Elvis out of the lab?
He asks. He's right, I agree. My grandfather makes an annoyed noise.
Fine, but I'm getting primary authorship.
We linger after we're done eating, hogging the table and reading fortune cookies. The restaurant is buzzing with the crush of Friday night, but our table is the center of my universe. I want this night to last forever. My grandfather has the waiter bring us more tea, and he fills our porcelain cups. His college ring is too big on his slender finger.
A toast,
he proposes. Raj looks at the cooler sitting in a chair.
To jellyfish?
But I shake my head because I already know the perfect toast.
To the possible, I say, meeting my grandfather's eyes.
He gives me a small smile. We all lift our teacups and say,
to the possible.
Chapter 25. Chill. When I wake up, my bedroom is freezing. Fall has finally arrived, and my mother doesn't like to turn on the heat unless it's below 65. She says it's California, not Alaska, and I should just put on a sweater. Even though it's cold, excitement warms my veins. The T. Melvinus is safe in the freezer in our garage, and my grandfather is full of plans for what to do next. He wants to get the ball rolling. Rent a space, set up a real lab, buy equipment, refine the compound. Then he'll be able to announce it to the world. I can hardly sleep waiting for the next part. Is this what Salk felt like when he knew his vaccine had worked? Maybe we will win a Nobel Prize. My grandfather's comments about what to wear tease at me. I've never been to anything fancy. What would I wear? A long dress? High heels? I remember that Marie Curie won a Nobel and wonder what she wore to the award ceremony. I decide to look it up. Most pictures show her in old-fashioned black dresses, and her hair was totally frizzy, just like mine. I can't find a photo showing what she wore to accept her Nobel, but I do discover something I hadn't known before. Something my grandfather left out. Marie Curie was exposed to a lot of radiation during her experiments. Eventually, it poisoned her. Her discovery killed her. It's windy and chilly on the lunch court. I'm standing in line with my tray waiting to pay. It's crispy corn dog day. Across the way, Raj and my grandfather are at our usual table. Their heads are bent together and my grandfather is scribbling in his notebook. Hi, Ellie. I turn around and freeze. It's Brianna. She's standing behind me, holding a bottle of juice. I wait to feel the burning stab of pain that usually accompanies her appearance, but it doesn't come. There's a twinge, an ache, the way a scraped knee feels after the swelling's gone down. I know I'll be fine. Hey, I say, how's volleyball? She hesitates. It's a lot harder than I thought. Super competitive. I'll have to try out again next season. Oh, I say. There's a moment of awkward silence. Then, Brianna looks down at my tray, gives me one of her old smiles. It's a crispy corn dog. I used to love them, she says, and it almost sounds like an apology. I swallow. Me too. And I feel relieved. Like this part is over somehow and it's okay. Because I've moved on. I've got my grandfather.
and Raj.
By the way, I saw your old sitter Nicole at the mall, Brianna says. She said to say hi.
I look across the lunch court at Raj, remember Nicole mentioning her discount.
Maybe I could get Raj an earring. Who's that boy you're with all the time? Brianna asks, following my line of sight.
That's Raj, I say.
I meant the one with the long hair, she clarifies.
Oh, that's my cousin Melvin. He's staying with us, I explain.
I didn't know you had any cousins out here, she says.
It's kind of a long story. A dreamy look crosses her face.
He's cute.
I half smile at her.
Huh?
She bites her lip.
Does he have a girlfriend?
Girlfriend? I echo and think of my grandmother's slippers.
Yeah,
she says, and I see the hopeful look in her eyes.
Do you think he'd like me?
My mind just keeps repeating again and again. Brianna thinks my 76-year-old grandfather is cute? I try to picture them kissing, and a cold feeling fills me.
Ellie, Brianna says.
I blink.
What do you think? She asks. Would Melvin like me?
I force myself to respond.
No, I say firmly. He's not really interested in that kind of thing.
Too bad, she says.
Chapter 26. Mummy. The house is toasty warm when I go into the kitchen to make breakfast. My grandfather's already sitting there dressed. My mother stomps in, demanding, "Who turned up the thermostat?"
"Not me," I say.
My grandfather gives her a cool look.
"I did."
"Why?"
"Because it's like an ice bucket in this place," he says. "You could preserve dead bodies."
"We're trying to save money," she says. He digs in his pocket and pulls out a $20 bill.
"Here,"
he says.
"Turn up the heat."
My mother and Ben are going to see a play a friend of hers is putting on. As they're walking out the front door, my grandfather trails after them.
"What time will you have her home?"
he asks Ben. "Excuse me," my mom says sarcastically. "I think I'm a little old for a curfew."
"I'm the babysitter," my grandfather says. "Don't you think I have a right to know what time you'll be home?"
"I'll have her home by midnight," Ben promises.
I pop popcorn and try to get my grandfather to watch a monster movie marathon with me. They're showing a bunch of black and white classics. Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Mummy, Dracula. But he tells me he's too busy.
"I need to work on my T. Melvinus paper. I'll have to submit it for peer review," he says.
I'm still watching at midnight when my grandfather walks into the den, looking angry.
"Your mother is late,"
he says. 10 minutes later, Ben's car pulls into the driveway, and my grandfather races out the front door. I follow him. He goes right up to Ben's car and bangs on his window. Ben rolls it down and looks at my grandfather in confusion.
"You're 10 minutes late,"
my grandfather tells him.
"There was an accident," Ben apologizes. "Then you should have given yourself more time."
His voice sounds like a 13-year-old's, but it has the authority of an adult's. After Ben drives away and we go inside, my grandfather and mother have it out.
"Were you kissing in the driveway? The whole neighborhood could see you."
My mother throws up her arms.
"So what?"
"What kind of example are you setting for your daughter?"
My mom loses it. "Excuse me, but am I living in 1950? Besides, you're out of line telling me what to do."
"I am your father."
"You may be my father, but I am the grown-up around here. You don't tell me what to do."
"I'm the grown-up,"
he shouts back at her. "Have you taken a look at yourself in the mirror lately?" she asks. "Because you are not a grown-up. You are a teenager." He glares at her and walks out of the room. We hear the bathroom door slam shut dramatically. She turns to me.
See? She says. Teenager.
There's a traveling Egyptian exhibition at the De Young Museum in San Francisco, and Raj invites me to see it with him. My parents love art, and I've practically grown up at the De Young. I know where all the bathrooms are. My dad likes to joke that I potty train next to Renaissance masters. My mom needs to borrow some props from a theater in the city, so she offers to drive us in. I invite my grandfather to come.
I don't have time to play,
he tells me, his fingers flying across the keyboard of his laptop.
I'm working on my patent application.
As we drive through Golden Gate Park, I notice another building, one we must have passed a million times, but I've never paid much attention to. The California Academy of Sciences. I suddenly want to know where every bathroom is in it, too. There's a huge line when we get to the De Young. I had no idea mummies were so popular. Raj fits right in with the San Francisco crowd. Nobody looks at him twice. We wind our way through the exhibition. In one room, they've recreated the inside of a tomb. The sarcophagus is surrounded by the dead man's belongings. Furniture, food, and a pair of leather slippers. It's like his life has been frozen in time, and I can't help but think of my grandfather's apartment. We finally make our way to the mummy that's the highlight of the exhibition. It's behind glass and is nothing like how I imagined. The body is small, maybe my size, and skinny. The bandages aren't white like in the movies. Instead, they're a dark brownish black and look like they've been melted onto the body. There's a hole where the nose should be, and the skin looks hard, like suede. But it's the hair that's the most disturbing. There's a long tuft of brown hair curling on the back of the mummy's head. I almost wish I hadn't seen it. Makes the mummy seem too real. I don't remember my grandmother's funeral, but I know she was cremated, and her ashes were scattered in San Francisco Bay. There's something I've always liked about that. Whenever I see the bay, I feel like I can hear her in the rolling waves and the shouting seagulls. Why did they do all this? I ask Raj. Why not just bury the body or cremate it?
Because they wanted to live forever.
He squints a half smile at me.
They thought their spirit could come back into the body if it was preserved. You know, kind of like what Melvin's doing.
Melvin's not dead, I say.
True, but he's sort of preserving himself,
he jokes.
Just like a mummy.
I stare at the tuft of hair.
Hey, come on,
Raj says and smiles.
Let's hit the next room. They've got a mummified cat.
Chapter 27 After. On the bus ride home from school, my grandfather holds up his science textbook. He must be running low on laundry because he's wearing the cast shirt for my mother's production of Hair. It's tie-dyed, and I think of Star Lily.
T. Melvinus will have its own chapter in here now,
he crows. Yeah, I say with a forced smile. He starts paging through the sections.
Where would it make most sense for them to put it?
When we get home, my grandfather heads to the kitchen for a snack, but I'm not hungry. My stomach feels a little weird, so I go into my bedroom and lie down. I can't stop thinking about mummies. It's so creepy. The dead waiting to come back to life? Maybe there's a reason they're monsters in horror movies. I look around my room with new eyes, and what I observe makes me question everything. The handprints on the wall. As people grow older, will hands get smaller instead of bigger because of T. Melvinus? The pink bow on my dresser from the birthday present Raj gave me. Will people have fewer candles on their cake every year because they're getting younger? I feel like Galileo. My vision of the universe suddenly appended. Before I know it, I find myself sitting at the computer, looking up the atomic bomb and Oppenheimer. All at once,
I need to know about the after. What happened after the bombs were dropped on Japan? Images flash across the screen. Crushed buildings. Smoke. Crying children. The article says that no one knows for sure how many people died from the bombings. One estimate puts the final death toll at 185,000. I'm good at math. I try to make this number something I can actually understand. There are 900 kids at our middle school, so it would be 200 middle schools worth of dead kids. Of kids like Raj and Momo and Brianna. And that's not even counting everyone else, like the school secretary and the janitor and all the teachers. Mr. Ham with his funny ties. My head swims. What if it happens again? Like Mr. Ham said, the genie is out of the bottle. Oppenheimer's words ring in my ears like a thousand bombs going off at once. We knew the world would not be the same. My grandfather's at the kitchen counter with his laptop, eating a burrito and drinking tea. The words bubble up out of me. What will they write? I ask him.
About what?
About us, in the textbooks. What will they write? He stares at me. I mean, will they say that Melvin Zagarsky and Ellie Cruz changed the world? Or that we've ruined it?
Ruined? We're saving people from old age. Just like polio.
But old age isn't the same as polio, I say. He shakes his head.
What has gotten into you? This is science. This is how discovery works.
I believe in science. But what if it isn't a good idea? What if we're not Salk? What if we're Oppenheimer? What if Team Melvinus is like the bomb?
Nonsense,
he says, and turns back to his computer, dismissing me. Brianna thinks you're cute, I burst out. He turns to me with a perplexed look.
Who's Brianna?
My friend. Ex-friend. I don't even know who she is anymore, but it doesn't matter. She wants to date you.
I'm a widower. I have no interest in dating.
He doesn't get it. He's like Marie Curie with the radiation. He doesn't see that it's going to poison everything. You're like a mummy, coming back to life.
You're not making any sense at all,
he says to me, like he's speaking to a toddler who's having a tantrum. I stare at his tie-dyed shirt, and I suddenly understand what Star Lily was trying to teach us with the goldfish. Endings are sad. Like goldfish dying in Grandma's slippers and Brianna and me. But beginnings are exciting. Like discovering something I might be good at and making new friends. Raj. It's the cycle of life, I say, remembering Star Lily's words. Things need to move forward, not backward.
Who wants to move forward? Not me.
My mind is racing now, and I think of things not moving forward. Like my mom. She's scared of making a mistake again, even though anyone can see that Ben's the perfect missing piece for her puzzle. What about the whole law of motion thing? You're supposed to keep moving or you get stuck, like Mom with Ben.
She can do better than him,
my grandfather says, ignoring what I'm really saying. What if we've gone too far? What if we ruin the whole world?
So dramatic. He observes. Just like your mother.
What about the trash cans? I ask.
I'll put them out tonight,
he says. How's that going to work? When all the old people are young again, who's going to be in charge? Who's going to decide when to put out the trash cans and turn up the heat? Who's going to be the grown-up? He looks momentarily off balance, as if he hasn't considered this. Then his expression hardens.
You don't understand. You haven't had to live through this,
he says. The words tumble from my mouth before I can stop them. But I want to! I look at him imploringly. Is growing up, growing old, life, is it all so terrible?
His eyes go still, and he looks at me, like he's seeing me for the first time. I take a deep breath, remember the feeling of dancing on that dark floor, the music pounding through me, the possibility of something, I don't know what, so close, and I want to feel that again. Because I want to try it, I whisper. I'm only 12. The garage door rumbles open. My mom walks into the kitchen carrying bags of takeout. I picked up Chinese, she says with a smile. And yes, Dad, I got your mugugai pan and extra soy sauce. He stares at the bags and then at me.
Well, I'm not hungry,
he says and walks out. My mom turns to me.
Guess there's a first time for everything.
Chapter 28 Observation. I'm wearing my warmest sweater, but it does nothing to warm the chill between me and my grandfather. At the lunch court, he eats his lunch in two bites and then races off.
What's going on with you guys?
Raj asks me. We had a fight, I say.
About what?
Just stuff, I hedge. As if stuff can describe a disagreement about the fate of all humankind. My mom hates having a half-empty theater on opening night, so she enlists me to help fill the unsold seats for our town. She gives me a ton of free tickets to pass out around school. During science class, I ask Momo if she'd like some. They're free, I explain. My mom's the director. Sure, she says. Will you be going? I make a face. Oh, I'll be there. She laughs. I know the feeling. I have to go to all of my brother's soccer games. Then she says, you want to do something after? Maybe get some frozen yogurt? I smile at her. That sounds great. Our town opens on Friday night. My mom's already at the theater getting everything ready, so Ben drives my grandfather and me over. My grandfather's wearing a jacket and tie. I expect him to complain about having to see our town, but he's unusually quiet. The theater is packed. I guess all my hard work paid off. I wave at Momo, who looks like she's brought her whole family. We settle down in our seats. The house lights go dark, and the curtains come up. Maybe I was too young when I saw it all those times before, because this time it's interesting. Or maybe it's the actors. My mom was right. The kids playing Emily and George are great, especially Emily. She starts out as a teenager. She grows up, gets married, and then dies while having her second baby. After she's dead, she comes back to Earth for one day as a 12-year-old, just like me. She has a line about whether anyone understands life when they're living it. I get what she's trying to say. Life is precious, and we don't realize that at the time. But maybe life's also precious because it doesn't last forever. Like an amusement park ride. The roller coaster is exciting the first time. But would it be as fun if you did it again and again and again? I can't help myself. I glance at my grandfather. His eyes are locked on the stage, transfixed. As if sensing me looking at him, he glances at me. Our eyes meet and hold. Something in his face softens, and I think for a moment that he gets it too. That he understands. But then he blinks. And looks away. The play gets great reviews. They even get a standing ovation on closing night. But at home, there's no clapping, no encore. It's just me and my grandfather not talking to each other. I put a new packet of ponytail holders out for him in the bathroom as a sort of peace offering, but he just leaves them there. Part of me wants to smooth everything over, tell him I was wrong. But deep down, I know I'm right. The world isn't ready for Team Elvinus. I wonder if this is what it's like to be a scientist. To believe in something so strongly
that you're willing to go against everything, even someone you love. Maybe I am a little bit mad after all. The house is empty when we get home from school. My mom's at the high school striking the set. My grandfather and I go our separate ways. Me to the kitchen, him to the bathroom. I'm full of nervous energy and decide to cook something. I flip through my grandmother's recipe box and settle on quiche. I make sure we have all the ingredients. Flour and butter for the crust. Eggs, ham, cheese. There's only one block of cheese, and it's way in the back of the refrigerator. When I pull it out, I realize it must have been in there for a long time. There's fuzzy, blue-green mold growing on it. My first reaction is to be grossed out, but my second reaction is to be intrigued. I kind of want to see what it looks like under a microscope. I get my microscope and set it up at the kitchen counter. I scrape off some of the mold, put it on a slide, and look at it through the eyepiece. It looks like delicate threads. My grandfather walks into the kitchen, carrying the catcher and the rye.
"The toilet's clogged again,"
he tells me.
"What are you looking at?"
I feel awkward explaining it to him. I was making a quiche, but the cheese was all moldy, so I decided to observe the mold under the microscope. He gives me an unfathomable look and says,
"Of course you did. That's what a scientist would do."
I don't know what to say. My grandfather holds up the book.
"I finished it. It was good."
My mouth drops open. "It was?"
"Yes. I judged it prematurely and I was wrong about it."
He hesitates.
"About other things, too."
He plucks an apple from the bowl of fruit. It's red and bruised, almost starting to go.
"You were right,"
he says with a lift of his shoulders. I hold my breath, waiting, hoping. He looks at the apple.
"The seed is planted. It grows into a tree. The fruit ripens, falls onto the ground."
He takes a bite. Juice drips down his chin.
"And then it starts all over again. The cycle of life. I don't need to be Galileo to make that observation."
I swallow.
"Science is powerful. There are always consequences, wonderful and terrible. I suppose I lost my way for a moment in all the excitement and forgot what Salk said."
"What did he say?" His eyes meet mine.
"Our greatest responsibility is to be good ancestors."
I nod. Then he heaves a great sigh.
"I guess this means I won't be getting a Nobel."
"Scientists don't give up. You can still get a Nobel someday. For something even more important. Something that nobody's ever done before."
"And what would that be?"
he asks, sounding skeptical. I point to the pimple on my chin. "Finding a cure for acne."
"Hmm. That would be revolutionary."
He shakes his head.
"Enough about all this. Is the plunger in the garage? I need to use it to clear the toilet. It took a few tries to get the T. Melvinus down."
"You flushed it? Why didn't you just put it in the trash?" He scoffs.
"The trash? Your mother would probably forget to put it out. Then raccoons would get into the cans and eat the T. Melvinus. And who knows what would happen next? Vicious raccoons that never get old rampaging around the neighborhood?"
We laugh. Chapter 29. Happy Beginnings. Nicole calls to tell my mom that she wants her old babysitting job back. The ear-piercing place is not turning out to be the great opportunity she thought it would be. My grandfather greets this news with enthusiasm.
"It's time for me to move on anyway,"
he informs us. I look at him in horror. "You're leaving?"
"I'll be back. Don't worry about that,"
he says.
"I have to make sure you get into a decent PhD program."
"But who's going to look after you?" my mother exclaims. "You're 13 years old." My grandfather gives my mother a steady look.
"Melissa, we both know this isn't working out. There are things I want to do, that I need to do, and I'll look after myself. I'm a grown-up.
She looks like she wants to disagree, but then she purses her lips. Where will you go? I ask him.
I'm not sure exactly. I thought I'd travel. Take a bus ride.
He pauses.
See the country.
I remember my grandmother's dream. My mother arranges for movers to put everything from his apartment in storage. She also gets him a cell phone and puts him on our family plan so that he can stay in touch on the road. On the day he's leaving, we wait with him in the bus station. It's bustling with people coming and going, rushing to catch buses leaving for everywhere. My grandfather's not sure where he's going. He says he has nothing but time and money. Will you be okay? My mother asks him.
Of course I will. I have 2 PhDs, he says firmly.
I hand him my going-away present.
What's this?
He asks, surprised. He opens the wrapped box and looks at what's inside. My collection of ponytail holders. Tears prick at my eyes. I don't want him to leave. I grab him, hug him tight. I love you, I say. My grandfather hugs me back, whispers in my ear.
I believe in you, Ellie. You're my possible.
I watch him board the bus and know I will never look at a bowl of fruit or cheese or anything ever in the same way again. It turned out that what I needed to teach me about life was my grandfather. He was the 14th goldfish. Everything's back to the way it was before, but it doesn't feel the same. The house is oddly empty. Who knew you could miss the smell of teenage boy socks? I decide my room needs a makeover. I don't want to look at all those little handprints anymore. My dad helps me one weekend when he's home. We paint the walls a deep sea blue. We use glow-in-the-dark paint to add jellyfish near the ceiling. When I lie in bed at night, it feels like I'm on the bottom of the ocean. Ananda has started his college search. Raj and I go with him the day he checks out Berkeley. The campus is beautiful. The lawns green and bustling with students. I can almost see Oppenheimer striding around, full of purpose. Momo and I have been spending a lot of time together lately. She's into scary films, too. We discover a whole category of old horror films about science gone wrong. Frankenstein, The Invisible Man, Tarantula, Godzilla, The Fly. Our favorite is Them. It's about a bunch of ants that turn into giant ant monsters after being exposed to radiation during the New Mexico atomic bomb tests. We even convinced Mr. Ham to do a class about monster movies in science. It's fun hanging out with another girl again. And there are other new beginnings. When Ben comes over to take my mother out to dinner, she meets him at the door, dressed and ready to go, waiting like a teenager on her first date. She steps across the threshold and into his arms, startling him. Yes, she says. He looks confused, but I know what she's saying.
I'll marry you.
They have a small ceremony at City Hall, with me as their witness. Ben wears a blue tie to match my mother's hair.
I love happy endings, the judge tells the newlyweds.
It's not a happy ending, I correct her. She looks at me quizzically. It's a happy beginning. I pay $20 to join the official Melvin Sagarsky fan club. I'm the 232nd member. They mail me a welcoming kit from Helsinki, Finland. It includes a membership card and a t-shirt with a picture of my grandfather on the front. He's staring at the camera, a Melvin-esque expression on his face. I miss him. And then the slippers start arriving. Bunny slippers, fuzzy pink slippers, thickly lined booty slippers, leopard print slippers, zebra slippers. The latest package contains slippers that look like alligators and a postcard from St. Augustine, Florida. There's a picture of an archway that says, Fountain of Youth. On the back,
My grandfather has included a mailing address and has written,
"Ha! P.S. My fan club has invited me to speak at their annual conference in Helsinki."